The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
All right, great. Thank you so much. Thanks for being at this talk. I know there's a lot of great competitors, and I want to start with a talk that has a very gloomy ending with actually some positive news. Well, I guess as positive as you can get with this story, which is that just yesterday, actually, I received news that about the case of a really famous left-wing Chilean singer named Victor Jara, who was assassinated and tortured by the Pinochet regime shortly after the coup. And it turns out that 45 years after his assassination, of the people responsible for his death have just now been convicted, which is both frustrating but also a little bit of past due justice. So this talk is going to be about the socialist movement in Chile between 1970 and 1973. It's a history of some of the most intense class struggle in world history, and it's also a story about a socialist movement which came towards the cusp of power but failed to actually take it, and a struggle in which very different ideas of socialism were posed at once that has really important lessons for today. Before I jump into it, I want to say a little bit about the sources that I use for this talk, just so I can get that out of the way. There are many, many sources that I use, but I wanted to highlight a few of them. One is in this book, Revolutionary Rehearsals. It's a short essay by a comrade named Mike Gonzalez called Chile, the Workers United. It has a wonderful bibliography that you can then work through. There's a book that he edited and that was authored by Ian Roxborough, Philip O'Brien, and Jackie Rodick called Chile, the State and Revolution, which is an excellent book. And then I also used some recent essays by a scholar named Frank Gaudichaud, which has some really great up-to-date historical analysis. And then finally, there's an amazing movie, which if you haven't seen already, you have to go watch. It's made by a documentary filmmaker who was actually there on the ground throughout these years, named Patricio Guzman. And it's called The Battle of Chile. It's 6 hours long. You can find it on the internet, but it's one of the most gripping kind of documents of working class struggle ever rendered on film, so you gotta go watch it. So the talk is gonna have three main parts. I'm first going to talk about a kind of picture of Chilean society at this time in history and the lead up to the socialist government that was in power from 1970 to 1973. Then I'm going to talk about the really ferocious class struggles that took place in those 3 years and the events culminating in the coup. And then finally, I'll give a very brief wrap up about some of the debates that exist on the left about those years. So let's jump right in. So to frame the discussion, I want to describe what the conditions in Chile were at the time. In 1970, but also going back to the mid-century. And I do this because I want to use what I think is a really important aspect of the Marxist method, and that's to begin with the kind of class structure of this country. What were the social classes present? What were their interests? And how did that lead them to kind of collide with one another? I think that really allows you to understand this trajectory of events better. So Chile in 1970, in this period, it's a country in the southern cone of Latin America. At that time, it had just under 10 million people. It had been through really, really rapid urbanization. So by the time this government takes power in 1970, 3/4 of the population is living in these really overcrowded cities that are full of shanty towns. Of that population, there's a subpopulation of about 3.5 million employees, and they're concentrated in manufacturing, services, construction, mining, transport, and agriculture. The country gets an enormous amount of its wealth through the exports of copper, upon which it was extremely dependent. Miners were the first kind of element of the Chilean working class at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th. They only constituted about 3% of the workforce, but again, 78% of the country's export wealth in 1970. And so the country had industrialized, but the kind of manufacturing that existed there was mostly for internal use and to supplement the really, really valuable exports in minerals. Another really important thing to note is that about 20% of these of this workforce were self-employed people, both in agriculture and in commerce and in transport. And that has really big ramifications for the future of the struggle because their interests aren't exactly aligned with workers who have bosses. They're a bit more hostile towards the ideas of nationalizing industry, towards unionization, and things of that nature. Chile's ruling class was also quite divided. So one really important thing to understand about Chile is it has a huge kind of monopolist capitalist class that owned giant chunks of the Chilean economy. So one group, a coalition of the Alessandri and Mate families, together owned 16.1% of the entire Chilean economy and 69 total corporations. Just three capital holding groups, three financial investment groups, controlled about 70% of all Chilean capital. Most capitalists were not like that. They were small and medium-sized business owners, but they only employed around 40% of workers and had a very small amount of the country's wealth. The agricultural system, the countryside, was extremely stratified in what is called the latifundio system. So at that time, in 1970, there were 253,000 landowners and around 30 million hectares of arable land. A group of just 730 landowners possessed more than half of that land, 16 million hectares. That fellow I mentioned, Alessandri, was also connected to this group of latifundistas, they're called. Meanwhile, the majority of people in the countryside are very small landowners, agricultural laborers, people who have just been recently displaced off of the land and were moving to the cities. So one of the biggest demands at the time was for land reform, and there was also a movement of indigenous Mapuche people who were seeking to reclaim the land that had been stolen from them. The other thing you really have to understand is the presence of U.S. imperialism. So 80% of foreign investment in Chile was from the U.S., and more than half of that was in the copper mines. There were three big American copper companies called Anaconda, Kennecott, and Cerro. They're all owned by the U.S., and they controlled about four-fifths of Chilean copper. Chile had the seventh largest amount of American investment out of any country in the world at the time. And the American military had very, very close ties with the Chilean military. They trained together, they funded the Chilean military, and they had continuous close contact with it, which comes to be crucial later in the story. So this is the kind of backdrop, and all these classes are constantly in conflict and interaction with each other. The small landowners are fighting the big landowners. Landless workers are struggling to get their land back. Big business owners are trying to destroy small business owners, and small business owners are trying to find a footing in the economy. Workers, the vast majority of the time, are fighting both big capitalists and the small and medium-sized capitalists in which they're employed. Small proprietors and self-employed people are kind of vacillating, sometimes collaborating with, sometimes fighting all these different classes. And this is the backdrop through which the story kind of plays out. One of the unique features of Chile, and this is also really important to understand, is that from the 30s on, it has a relatively stable parliamentary system. Every 6 years, there are presidential elections, and every 3 years, there are congressional elections. And it gains a reputation for having a well-functional parliament, which was also extremely important for later events. Workers were mostly organized through the socialist and communist parties, which were both extremely influential. In fact, there was a popular front government that was a coalition of liberals, socialists, and communists that was in power in the late 30s and early 1940s. And the way it kind of broke down was that actually the Communist Party, which was closely aligned with the Comintern in Moscow, was more conservative than the Socialist Party. It was more, it advocated during this period a more kind of cautious, moderate line. So throughout the mid-century, there's intense class struggle. It goes up and down, and its kind of climax is the Allende years between 1970 and 1973. But the left was, growing in strength from 1950 onwards. So, one of the things that's less known is that actually Salvador Allende, who's the president from 70 to 73, came within a hair's breadth of winning the presidency in 1958. So his electoral front, which was a coalition of the communists and socialists, lost by only 30,000 votes to Jorge Alessandri from the Alessandri family, his national party in the 1958 elections. And then the next year, the revolution in Cuba happened. And this really terrified both the Chilean ruling classes throughout Latin America and the United States, and it caused them to kind of fundamentally shift their strategy and their approach to politics in the region. The result was an experiment around a political movement called Christian Democracy. So there's a Christian Democratic Party whose leader at the time is named Eduardo Frei. And he is in communication with a lot of different politicians. Crucially, one of them is Kennedy. So Kennedy helps to launch an initiative called the Alliance for Progress. And the goal of that initiative is basically to implement a reformist project in Latin America that takes up some of the poor and kind of popular masses' demands in order to stave off the threat of socialism and communism. So the Christian Democrats build a movement centered around land reform, in the countryside, increased social welfare, legislation to curb monopolies, some limited unionization efforts. They dubbed this all a revolution in liberty. They wanted to buy back shares to put some of the copper mines under more Chilean control, and they tried to combine the interests of some of the smaller medium capitalists, people in the countryside, workers, and crucially, sections of the bigger capitalists who were really afraid of the socialists and thought that this could be a strategy to stop them. They were very successful, and in 1964, Eduardo Frei managed to convince most of the Chilean ruling class to support him in the election, and he did better than any candidate had done up until that point in history. He got 56% of the vote in 1964, and he was enormously popular, including among basically half of the working class. So popular unity, which came to be the name of the Socialist Communist Coalition, they did well in that election too, but they were dwarfed by the Christian Democrats. However, this strategy very quickly backfired. Instead of people kind of accepting this more moderate reform program, it just emboldened them. And there was an increase in struggle and land occupations and factory occupations and strikes from the mid-60s all the way until 1970. So in 1960, there were 257 strikes in Chile. That number went up to 564 in 1964, the year of the election. And by 1968, it had shot up to 1,124. And it kept going up all the way through in 1969. This also caused a big split within the whole Christian Democrat reformist movement. So the left section of that movement, called the MAPU, or the Movement of Unified Popular Action, split off from the Christian Democrats in 1969 and decided to go socialist, to join the socialist movement. And actually what's interesting is that half of the MAPU became occupied the radical left flank of the socialist movement during the Allende years. So these developments again scared the Chilean ruling class. They kind of began to abandon the Christian Democratic strategy, and that sets the stage for 1970. By 1970, support for the socialist movement had grown enormously, and that sets that was the basis for the election win that year. So a new coalition is formed that incorporates that MAPU formation alongside a smaller left-wing middle-class party called the Radical Party, and then the socialists and communists, who are still the dominant forces within it. This time, Allende won the election, and Popular Unity had the chance to form a government. Interestingly, one radical left group decided to stay out of the coalition. It was called the MIR, which is the Revolutionary Left Movement, and it was very inspired by the Cuban Revolution. It believed in ideas of armed struggle, but it also had important connections with sections of landless workers, people in the shanty towns, and that was sort of their orientation. They played a pivotal role, and actually one of their leaders was Allende's nephew, so there was a lot of connections there. So Allende, this self-professed Marxist, becomes president of Chile, and socialists and communists take key positions in the parliament, in its various ministries, and even in the police. Like I said, the leadership of the Communist Party and the Socialist Party believed in a Marxist project and had as their goal the establishment of a socialist society. But what's crucial to understand is that Allende, the Communist Party, and the right wing of the Socialist Party all had a very particular view of how this would play out. They thought that the key mechanism they had to use to establish socialism in Chile was the parliament, constitutional procedure, and a kind of gradual transformation of society. They very consciously rejected the model of the Russian Revolution, the model of sort of replacing the state with popular working class organizations. Partly they were unsatisfied with how the Russian Revolution played out, and they were also believed that Chile's parliamentary system was so stable that they could actually implement socialism in that way. So in Allende's first speech to Congress, he says that, quote, "The skeptics and prophets of doom will say that socialism through parliament is not possible. They will say that a parliament that has served the ruling classes so well cannot be transformed into the parliament of the Chilean people. Further, they have emphatically stated that the armed forces and the corps of police, who have up to the present supported the institutional order that we wish to overcome, would not consent to guarantee the will of the people if these should decide on the establishment of socialism in our country. They forget the patriotic conscience of the armed forces and the police, their tradition of professionalism, and their obedience to civil authority. Since the National Congress is based on the people's vote, there is nothing in its nature which prevents it from changing itself in order to become, in fact, the parliament of the people. The Chilean armed forces and the police, faithful to their duty and their tradition of non-intervention, will support a social organization which corresponds to the will of the people, as expressed in the terms of the established constitution. It will be a more just, a more humane, and a generous organization for everybody, but above all for the workers who have contributed so much up to the present and have received almost nothing in return." So that pretty much sums up how Allende viewed socialism. He and his colleagues, their ultimate aim was to establish full public control over production. They even toyed around with ideas of workers' participation and control in industry, but it was all through this gradualist parliamentary system. And they also faced one really, you know, profound problem, which is that they only had 36% plurality in the parliament at that time. So they tried to base some of their political strategies on the philosophy of the preceding government of Eduardo Frei and the Christian Democrats. They tried to form an alliance with the medium-sized and small-sized capitalists by subsidizing them, by supporting them against the monopolists. They oriented on what they called the capas medias, or the middle layers, and argued that in fact a socialist project would benefit in Chile not just the working class, but the middle class as well. And they tried to moderate their reform project for the time being until they could win a full majority in parliament. And this was deeply ironic because it turned out that those very forces they were trying to build an alliance with would be their most implacable and militant enemies. So they agreed to sign what was called a statute of guarantees forced upon them by the Christian Democrats that committed them to preserving the current state order, the police, the military, the entire legal system. And that already began to cause a lot of tension in the popular unity government, because the left wing of the Socialist Party, the MAPU, and other forces like the MIR that I mentioned earlier, were all really opposed to the statute of guarantees. So how did workers respond? They basically just continued striking and struggling as they had been under the administration of Eduardo Frei. Factory occupations continued throughout the first year of popular unity. And as all this was happening, the government began to initiate its reform project. And a lot of that had to do with nationalizing some of the big monopolies in Chile, which, of course, capitalists were fiercely opposed to. So they began with the complete nationalization of copper. They tried to nationalize the 150 largest firms in the country in the entire financial sector, and to bring most exports and imports under control of the government. Still, they would leave most of the economy in private hands, so that by the end of 1971, the sort of social sector, as they called it, only accounted for 20% of the total economy. But workers kind of forced them to go further. So in the first year of the administration, all sorts of workers began to occupy their factories and demand that they be nationalized under their control. Beer brewers, tire makers, Ford auto workers, and textile workers in 14 different plants occupied and forced the nationalization of their workplaces during the first year of the government. So all this is happening. So in some respects, this wasn't completely unprecedented. The state had played a large role in the Chilean economy previous to the Popular Unity government, but the militancy of the working class and the commitment of the government to socialism was, you know, anathema to the interests of the capitalist class in Chile. So they launched a kind of all-out assault to try and stop this. There was constant legal wrangling in Congress. The ruling class used all the kind of measures that it could to try to prevent popular unity from carrying out this agenda. They used their majority in the Congress to kick out left-wing ministers. They began pulling out their investments from Chile. They sent their money elsewhere. They openly sabotaged the factories, and they were assisted in this by, remember, the group that had the largest foreign interest in Chile, which was the Americans. So the U.S. immediately stopped all civilian aid and credit to Chile. The only aid they continued was military aid, because they had close connections with the Chilean military over many years, and they saw that Allende intended to keep the leadership structure of the military intact. Also, of course, the Americans were very powerful, so they pressured other institutions. The World Bank also stopped all credit to Chile. This is a developing country, so those were really serious economic wounds inflicted on the country. And finally, the U.S. government launched a campaign to force companies to boycott Chilean copper. And remember how important copper was to their economy, if that had worked, and it began to in roughly 1972. It would be extremely disastrous. So after, you know, the first year in office, all these kind of measures that Chilean capitalists and capitalists internationally are taking really start to take their toll on the country. Living standards start to deteriorate. There are shortages of goods. And this, produces yet another debate within the socialist movement about how to proceed. The left wing of the government argues we have to accelerate the process of nationalization and take more and more control over the economy to try and combat these attacks. That became known as the Vuskovic plan, named after the economy minister Pedro Vuskovic. They wanted to socialize about half the economy right away, and they tried to use laws that were passed during the Popular Front government in the 30s and 40s to allow them to do that. Then the Congress, of course, tried to stop them. There was a legal back and forth for like 6 months that provoked mass demonstrations and strikes because the government was stalled around these issues. Allende was very, very clear to his supporters that you can't go any further than what the parliament allows right now, because he thought that the movement would basically imperil the standing of the government. And he was actually willing to use force to get across that message. So he sent police to repress workers' protests at various occasions. The most serious of those was in May 1972 in the city of Concepcion, where a lot of workers were beaten up by the police. As I said, the economic situation continued to deteriorate. At this time also, the Chilean fascist movement is making serious gains. So there's a big far-right movement in Chile centered around this group called Patria y Libertad, Fatherland and Freedom. And they launch violent attacks on factories. They try to terrorize workers and leftists. It would essentially be like at every conference where you are, you fear for your life. That was the atmosphere. And so this kind of this dynamic of struggle outside the parliament just continues to intensify, and there's just boiling anger and frustration by all of the classes at one another about the future of the country. And this all comes to a head in 1972. There's one really, really significant development in 1972 that marks a departure from the whole previous period, and that's in June 1972. It takes place in a part of Chile called Cerrillos, Maipú, and that's just outside the capital city, Santiago. Cerrillos is the industrial heartland of Chile. It employed at that time 46,000 manufacturing workers in 250 enormous factories, all clustered right next to each other. So it was the most industrial zone of Chile, and Maipú was right next to it, and it was the area with the poorest agricultural workers who'd been forced off their land and were trying to fight for land reform. In this area in 1972, they established what was called the Industrial Belt, or in Chile, or in Spanish, it's called Cordón. Now, what this did was, instead of operating like a traditional union where your workplace, ideally if it's run democratically, elects a kind of delegate to represent you, the cordon represented the whole area geographically. So every single factory and workplace would democratically elect a delegate to this committee, and then that committee as a whole would control the kind of decisions in struggle of the whole of the whole area. It was democratically run. Every delegate was immediately recallable to its base, and it represented both farm workers and industrial workers as they were trying to fight their bosses. And this was a really big advance. And not only was it an advance in practice, but the workers in in this cordon put forward a very unique and new vision of what socialism meant to them. They put forward a program for the continuation of the struggle in Chile. And I want to read just a few planks of this program because I think it's really fundamental. One, support President Allende's government insofar as it interprets the struggles and mobilizations of the workers and pursues their interests. Expropriate all monopoly firms and those with more than 14 million escudos, as well as all industries which are anyway strategic, all those which belong to foreign capital, and all those which boycott production or do not fulfill their commitment to the workers. Immediate workers' control in all industries, farms, mines, and so on through delegates, councils, delegates being immediately recallable by the base. Take possession of all farms which have been marked for expropriation and set up the popular assembly to replace the bourgeois parliament. So this was extremely significant because, again, this is the kind of center of the industrial manufacturing working class in Chile, and they've just put forward a different idea of socialism than the one that the government is advocating for. They're arguing that actually what socialism has to mean is that we have to build working class organizations from the bottom up around the country and put them in the authority to run the economy, not rely on the parliament to do it on our behalf. And that was a really kind of a watershed moment because it contrasted two different ideas of socialism, one from below through working class popular organization, one from above through parliament or the old state. Okay, so moving right along. At the same time, they neighborhoods were organizing supply committees to help them deal with the crisis of the shortage of goods. These were called the HAPS, or the Popular Supply Committees. That's the acronym in Spanish. And they helped people to survive while there were all these strikes going on. People were pulling out investment. And the situation kind of looks something like what one sees in Venezuela in recent years, where there's such a shortage of goods that you go to the market and there's nothing on the shelves. The struggle escalated even further in the fall of that year, 1972. And that's not so much because of anything that the workers did immediately. It's actually because of how the ruling class and the middle classes responded. And I think this is really crucial because in order to understand Chile, we have to remind ourselves that it's not just workers who can organize and strike and protest. It's also all the other classes in society who can potentially do that. So for several months, the big businesses coordinated with small business owners that they could win to their side, and even individual proprietors, the so-called self-employed sector that I pointed out earlier, to try to plan an enormous national strike and shut down the economy indefinitely to use leverage against the government. And part of what's so funny about this is that you have a socialist government really, really committed to gradualism and parliamentarism, and then you have a ruling class and a middle class which just doesn't care about any of those things and is committed to destroying the country and shutting everything down just to get their way. They managed to do this. They were led in part by the truck drivers. And in October of 1972, they began a national strike. So this has to be unpacked a little bit. Most truck drivers in Chile at the time were individual truck owners. They didn't work necessarily for trucking companies. This means that they were very hostile to being taxed. They didn't want regulation of their industry. They didn't want the industry to be nationalized, all the things that the government was trying to do. And also their political leadership was from the right. In fact, some of it was from the far right and the fascist movement. This is not all of the truck owners, but it was the majority. And so they started to take direct action to shut down the country by in some cases disassembling their trucks, putting armed guards around parking lots of trucks, and refusing to transport any goods. And in order to understand the impact of this, picture Chile on a map. What does Chile look like? It's an extremely long strip. It's 2,600 miles tall and only about 100 miles wide on average. What does that mean? It means that any two points in Chile are likely to be much farther away from each other than two points in a country that's like a square or like a circle. So transport was extremely critical. And if you could shut down transport, you could potentially shut down the country. And that's what they did. Starting in October, truck drivers went on strike. Small business owners shut their shops. Big business owners locked workers out of their factories, started disassembling machines. They tried to literally shut down the entire economy. This included many doctors who tried to close hospitals, lawyers who stopped working. This was a big mass movement of the middle classes and the ruling class against the left. Now workers were faced with a problem unlike those that they had faced in the past. Instead of shutting down production in order to get their way, they had to basically save production in order to save the left. Okay, so remarkably, they did essentially exactly that. The cordones, which had emerged in Cerrillos Maipú, began to spread all over the country. And workers, instead of just kind of submitting to this strike, occupied all the factories and began to run production on themselves. They also requisitioned cars and trucks to begin transporting stuff where the truck drivers hadn't done it. They won all of the truckers and small business owners they could to their side. They put armed guards around cities and factories and essentially just began to try to run the economy without the the leadership of the bosses, which was often very difficult to do, but they tried their hardest and they managed to keep the economic system afloat. This situation intensified and lasted from October 1972 all the way through mid-November 1972. The leaders of the strike from the ruling class had expected that by this time the government would have fallen. But the direct action of the workers and the mass expansion of these cordones, these industrial belts, allowed the country to kind of stay alive during this period. And as a result, the right saw that it needed to actually negotiate a compromise solution because they didn't really have a shot to overthrow the government at this point. So the right began to negotiate with Allende. Allende, of course, if you're familiar with his history, you'll be able to guess that he tried to actually force the workers to back down in order to achieve a compromise position with the ruling class strike leaders because he didn't think that they could advance the revolution any further without a majority in parliament and without going through the legal procedures. So Allende argued with the members of the movement that they needed to end the factory occupations, return most of the factories to their original owners, in exchange for the leaders of the right recognizing the government. Allende and the heads of the Communist Party agreed to incorporate military generals into the cabinet. It as a way to secure or to ensure the kind of security, its peace and stability of the country. So they introduced three military generals into the cabinet, and at the same time they also incorporated some leaders of the left to try to placate them. The problem was that workers wouldn't accept this position. They just simply did not relinquish control of most of the factories. So the government was kind of forced to back down. Some factories were returned, but actually the majority that were occupied during this time were kept in the workers' hands or kind of just kept in limbo where it wasn't really certain what was going to be happening. This was a really liberatory experience. Workers were taking over their factories and essentially telling their bosses just to leave. And in many cases, successfully getting the state to nationalize it and to put it in large part under their control. So it was a really revolutionary situation. New Year happens, and the right decides that it has to focus on the congressional elections in March 1973 as the next opportunity to try and use the atmosphere of chaos to discredit the government, decrease its vote. And if the right could get two-thirds of the parliament, it could impeach Allende and bring down the government. So the whole kind of movement turned to electoralism on the different sides. People campaigned really ferociously to try and get their parties a victory. And actually, this also backfired on the right. So in popular unity, instead of losing its vote, it increased it from 36% all the way up to 44%. Increasing number of workers supported the government, especially the base of the Christian Democrats. They continued to veer to the left. So the left celebrated these elections. They saw it as a mandate to go further. The military generals were kicked out of the cabinet, and workers started clamoring for more nationalizations, expansion of things like of the cordones. The response, unfortunately, of Allende and the leadership of the right wing of the Socialist Party and the Communist Party was that 44% is not a majority. In order to fully socialize the whole economy, we need at least a majority in the parliament so that we can pass everything through in the proper way and establish socialism with legitimacy and a chance of a kind of longevity. That was essentially their argument. So they said we have to restrain the movement at precisely this time. So all sorts of strife continued to happen because, of course, workers didn't want to accept this. The right also didn't want to either. And many events took place in that first half of 1973, but the next major event took place at the end of June. On June 29th, there was an attempt of a military coup. It was led by a general called Roberto Super. And the military was divided over the decision. He hadn't won a sufficient number of the generals to overthrow the government, who feared even increased instability, and maybe a reaction by workers that would just make things even worse for them. So this coup was actually toppled by sections of the military under someone who was considered an ally of Allende named General Prats. Still, the leaders of Popular Unity were really, really alarmed. So when the coup happened, they actually argued that the workers should recommence factory occupations. So the head of the trade unions, which tended to be a bit more conservative than the Cordones, called for factory occupations. The chiefs of both the Communist Party and the Socialist Party did as well. And the reaction was overwhelming. The factory occupations spread even further than they ever had before. Entire cities were waving the red flag. There were armed guards around, you know, factories in Santiago, the capital, all around the country. And in Santiago, a citywide cordon was formed, meaning that all of the major workplaces had delegates to a single cordon or industrial belt covering the entire city. And that was even more of an advancement, because if people had been looking, what that implied was that you could build new forms of government directly based in the working class that could run cities. And the implication is, why not expand further from there? Once again, though, after the threat of the coup subsided, Allende looked to compromise. He thought that the failed coup would be a stinging defeat to the right, that it would show them that they had no hope of bringing down this government, and that they would accept more of his measures. And again, his political allies in the right wing of Popular Unity agreed with that, and they tried to effect a compromise in a series of negotiations in the parliament, and once again, workers just absolutely refused. Even depoliticized workers, moderate workers, or conservative workers were now thrust into taking positions that were far to the left of the ones that the heads of the government were taking. I'll just give you one example, which to me is fascinating. So there's a factory in Santiago called the El As textile factory. Almost all the workers are women from the Christian Democratic Party. And this is the speech of one woman worker who says the following. Look, this statement here is a betrayal of the working class, referring to a statement from the government. The trade union solution is to talk with the bosses and to reach an agreement with them, giving them back the factories. That's what it's all about. I was never very much one for mixing in politics. We never talked very much about the process of moving towards socialism, but now we're all involved in it and we know what it means. And we all can say, all we can say is that this statement is a betrayal of our class. Perhaps this is a small factory, but at the bottom, what's important here is political and not economic. If we workers want power, we shall never get it by giving back factories, however small they may be, end quote. So this is, this is not a radical worker, but this is someone who's radicalizing in the course of struggle, who's going further than the government wants them to go. And I just have a couple more minutes here to wrap up. So in the face of this really immense pressure, the Popular Unity and the Christian Democrats tried to negotiate a solution. And this was their compromise solution, which to me just shows how radical the state of the country was at the time. They would allow half of the factories that had been occupied after the coup to remain in national hands. And as a compromise, the other half would just become worker cooperatives, which to us sounds like, practically a revolutionary situation. But at that time, the calculation of the Christian Democrats was that if you can keep these factories in the free market, maybe you can win them back later on. Some factories kind of submitted, but keep in mind now, there had been two huge waves of struggles, right? A big strike and then a coup, and the position of the leadership of the left had been to vacillate. And so profound confusion started to kind of set in. Workers kept organizing in great numbers and taking measures of direct control, but at the same time, the government kept kind of trying to roll that back every time. And the result was a cycle of attacks and counterattacks that didn't seem to have any end in sight. So people started to ask themselves, like, what is the end goal here if after every time we pour our hearts out in struggle, we haven't defeated the enemy and the struggle just kind of repeats in a loop. So just 2 weeks after this compromise was struck, a second national strike of equal proportion to the first one in October 1972 begins again. This one is in August 1973. The truck drivers completely shut down production. They sometimes literally destroy their trucks. The opposition in the parliament passes a new law called the Arms Control Law, which calls upon the military to find and confiscate all illegal weapons. And the military uses that as an excuse to go in, raid workers' neighborhoods, raid factories, looking for weapons and arresting people who had weapons. Okay, perfect. I'm about to wrap up. So a whole new cycle began again. It looked very similar to what had happened in October 1972. The Corralones went into action. They tried to keep production up and going. They requisitioned trucks to transport goods around the country. But this time there was a palpable loss of a bit of momentum. You have to try to imagine going through the same intense motions which drains you of all of your energy, but not sensing that there's any steps in place to actually end this struggle and to put you in a position of control. That pattern of compromise set by the government gave people little reason to believe that there was going to be a kind of positive end outcome to the crisis. All the while, military units are carrying out these really ferocious raids in different factories and workplaces. So throughout this period, the left wing of Popular Unity, the MIR, the Revolutionary Left Movement, they're criticizing the government, they're opposed to these negotiations, but they'd never really put forward an alternative vision of what could happen, aside from calling for further nationalizations and escalation of the struggle. There was no left group in Chile at the time that was making the same argument the Corralones in certain areas were making, but on a larger scale, which was that you could actually put these new organizations that workers were building in power and establish them as the new state authority rather than the parliament. Even the MIR, which was the far left of the movement and the most critical of Allende's parliamentary orientation, they actually viewed the Corralones pretty dismissively because they thought that the solution was going to come through more of an armed struggle. And it also happened that most of the leaders of the Corralones were from the Socialist Party, so there was a bit of a partisan dynamic there. Now, I'm not saying that project would have been easy. To put these new organizations in power of a country, to assemble them on a nationwide level, would have taken months, if not years, a very careful effort. But the point is that it was possible, and you had to organize it and really commit yourself to it to execute that vision. And unfortunately, the impetus for that on a national level just didn't exist. So by this time, it's late summer, early fall 1973, the military leadership is starting to become one in their majority to the perspective that Popular Unity government has to be overthrown by force of arms. In this last section, I'll just describe what that looked like. Allende and most of the Popular Unity leadership, they believed that the military was split between a constitutionalist wing committed to the parliamentary process and a conservative wing who would just serve the ruling class no matter what. And there were some events that had transpired that kind of seemed to lend credence to that argument. So right after Allende won in 1970, there was a coup attempt immediately led by a guy named Roberto Vau. And they kidnapped all the constitutionalist generals, René Schneider, Augusto Pinochet, the future dictator, and Carlos Prats. They killed René Schneider when he tried to avoid kidnap. And then René Schneider was made like a national hero, a figure of the left, an exemplar of military patriotism, and this whole argument about trust in the military leadership. When Prats resigned from the cabinet during the crisis in late August, early September, Allende appointed Pinochet as his chief of staff. Not only that, but Pinochet was seen as the most trusted general to the government. He not only was on the chief of staff, he served on the Popular Unity's own military intelligence committee. So he was the sort of liaison, giving them intelligence about what was happening in the military, while he was actually the person nominated by the military to lead the new military dictatorship. So you can see how kind of delusional that perspective was about the so-called split within the military leadership. There were U.S. Chilean military exercises in the Pacific. Those were used as a cover to coordinate support between the U.S. government and the Chilean government. And finally, on September 11th, military moved in, executed the coup. Allende was lost his life in the presidential palace on that day, and just the repression was extremely bloody, and the onslaught began from there. They rounded up people in the National Stadium, tortured them. We still don't exactly know all of the details. And there was a lot of resistance and guerrilla movements that continued for many years afterwards. But there was no structure in place for a kind of centralized and coordinated counterattack. That would have required a lot of training and years of practice. And the whole left, including even the far left, believed that the military would never go completely to the side, that it would split. There was no orientation that you had to try to win the rank and file soldiers against the officers. That concept didn't exist. And this US-backed Pinochet dictatorship was in power for 17 years, all the way until 1990. So my last statements, and I'm sorry for going on so long, is just about how the left kind of reacted. This is happening in 1973, which is sort of like the outset of the period that is now called neoliberalism, this whole period of defeats for the working class, demoralization of the left. And the conclusion that most of, you know, the established communist and socialist parties around the world took was that in Chile they went too far. What they proved in Chile is that if you don't moderate your demands enough, there's going to be violent civil wars and clashes that destroy the left, which I think was the kind of opposite lesson that needed to be derived from that experience. And we have to ask ourselves the question, was Allende right that you had to wait for a parliamentary majority in order to kind of carry out a socialist revolution? And I think that he wasn't. In almost any respect. I think that by the time 1973 goes around, as we saw in the example of the factory occupations after the coup in late June, the majority of the population was already won to the working class struggle. I think that majority had been won already, but just wasn't expressed through the parliamentary system. And there was just no notion, no willingness to believe that unless you organize the working class from the bottom up to defend itself and equipped it to do so, that the movement would be crushed. This kind of wholesale belief in parliamentarism and gradualism and socialism through the established institutions of the state acted as a real fetter on the further advance of the movement. And that makes it one of the great tragedies of working class and socialist history. But As I think you'll probably agree, it's also really, really inspiring history because it showed what workers are capable of doing when they organize together. If I'll leave you with one thing, it's that you have to watch that movie, the Battle of Chile, because unlike a lot of previous cases, this whole thing is documented on film in great detail, and you feel like you're there in a way that's not quite possible with earlier struggles. So I look forward to, you know, hearing your questions and talking about this in the discussion, and so we can share this history with many others in the year to come and generalize its lessons. So thank you so much.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.